Good afternoon, everybody. It's your boy, Big Dave Martell, here on another episode of The Bog, which is usually live every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. However, we have a very special one-on-one interview that we are going to get to in a second. But before we get started, make sure to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You get a sticker. You can get a mug. There's all kinds of stuff over there. So help us keep the lights on and go check out patreon.com/thebog. And most importantly, you can get the RSS feed to get audio of every single show that we do to listen to in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That's patreon.com/thebog. If you want to support the bog another way, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. Guys, winter is here. If you're like me and you're from the Beast Coast and it's freezing cold outside with all kinds of snow, you're going to want to get yourself a nice bog beanie, hoodie, all kinds of stuff over there. Support us over there at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to go to facebook.com/ironagejodish. Our boy Neil John does authentic ancient Vedic astrology. It's so super cool. You guys are going to love it. You guys seen Neil John. We just did an episode with him last week, and we've done multiple episodes. Guy's brilliant. His work is excellent. So go check him out, facebook.com/ironagejodish, and give him a like. And if you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Guys, Bizarre Archives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines, a project created by yours truly, a compilation of aspiring pulp authors from both United States and Great Britain coming together to create a compilation of short stories in the genres of fantasy, science fiction, and cosmic horror. Go get yourself a copy because we have two releases coming out very soon. Next couple days, Cosmic Horror Double Feature, and also Bizarre Archives Issue 2 coming in December. But so today we have a very special guest, and like I mentioned before with the Bizarre Archives, you know, there's a lot of English authors, there's a lot of English bog lords out there, bog maidens, a lot of folks from the UK like the bog and reach out to me. Got a lot of friends over there, and I often get the question, hey, is there any organization that I can join over here on my side of the pond? And, you know, here on the bog, we love to shine a spotlight on the real living community, the living tradition, the guys out there that are building and making it happen and stuff like that. But unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer for the organizations that are over there in the UK. I know what they're called. I've read what's on their website. I've spoken with a few members online. However, I haven't had a chance to really familiarize myself with all the awesome stuff that our brothers overseas are getting into. So I figured I'd get one of the guys on here himself, and we can have a chat with him, and so everybody can get familiarized themselves. So we have a very special guest, Mr. Ralph Harrison of the Odinist Fellowship, all the way across the ocean, is here with us this morning. Good evening, or good morning, Mr. Ralph.
Hello. Yeah, well, it's afternoon here, but good morning, or good evening, or good afternoon, whatever's applicable. Hello. So I suppose you want me to tell you a little bit. My name is Ralph Harrison, and I'm the director of the Odinist Fellowship, as you mentioned, and also the priest in charge of the Newark Odinist Temple. That's Newark, Nottinghamshire, England, obviously not Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah, no, you don't want a temple there.
And it's a much smaller place than Newark, New Jersey. But yes, it's the first Odinist temple in Great Britain. And in fact, it was the first Odinist temple of modern times. I know you've got three now in the United States of America, which is great. We slightly predated that, but that's great. In the Odinist Fellowship, our reason for existence is to practice, promote, and propagate Odinism, which is, when I'm asked, I know a lot of your listeners will know a lot about it, but maybe some won't. And when I'm asked, what is it? I generally reply in simple terms that it's the original old religion of the English people. Now, obviously, it's wider than that because it's also the native faith of the northern lands, of the lands that are inhabited by Germanic-speaking peoples or of Teutonic heritage, and further afield in the New World, in America and elsewhere, where our people have emigrated and settled. So it's, but as we're in England and mainly speaking to an English audience, I generally say it's the old religion of the English people. And the immediate response to that, oh, if someone's being critical, if someone is being an objective observer, as it were, would be to say, what on earth are you reviving this long dead religion for? And what, isn't it that a bit crazy? Isn't that a bit hopelessly romantic? Is it really a bit futile? I would answer that critique, that basic critique, by reference to our the spiritual scene and religious scenario that exists in Great Britain, in Western Europe. Is a little bit different from America, but here we have experienced the total collapse of Christianity, and people from America may not appreciate just how far gone that is. The churches have collapsed within themselves, so people have abandoned the churches. They're no longer attending, they're no longer presenting their children for baptism or even getting married in church. They're no longer interested, they've turned off altogether. And this is a twofold collapse of Christianity. It's partly the people have abandoned this historic faith, and it's partly that within the churches themselves, there's been a retreat from Christian teaching, from the long established Christian teaching of the various churches by the clergy themselves. So within the Protestant churches, there's been a moving away, a retreat from scriptural norms, which for centuries represented what Protestantism was supposed to be about. And within the Catholic Church also, obviously worldwide, Vatican II has more or less repealed the status quo that was established by the Council of Trent and the First Vatican Council, which has caused a great deal of confusion and distress amongst Roman Catholics. So the clergy themselves no longer really believe in what those churches are identified with and what those traditional teachings used to uphold. So how can it places Christianity in a very difficult situation. How can anyone consider rejoining those who have deserted the army, as it were? How can they consider rejoining it when the army itself, the Christian churches, are in full retreat? Added to that, this has left a great spiritual vacuum in our countries. So for the most part, people don't even think about religion. It doesn't cross their mind. But of course, that's not what the human condition is about. It may, in our country now, be regarded as eccentric, or you're out on a limb if you're interested in religion, whatever religion that is, whether it's Christian or Onanist or whatever religion, because we're in such a minority. But in fact, in the world as a whole, it's the secularists who are eccentric and out on a limb, because the world as a whole, still today, is a hugely religious place, and getting more religious actually as the years go by. So secularism isn't the normal status quo of humanity. And naturally, people are looking for spiritual answers and spiritual direction and answers to the questions of what is the meaning of life and so on. And ultimately, only religions can answer this question in their own particular ways. And atheism is a very difficult philosophy or ideology to really live in practice. People who are atheists tend to believe in it or advance that idea at an intellectual level. But when it comes to living the life, really, the normal, the intrinsic a consequence of atheism is hedonism. There's no purpose to life as an atheist, so you live for your own pleasure and your own self-interest, and that's all there is to it. And as the atheist philosophers and the existentialists have elaborated, their view of the universe is that it's absurd and futile. Now, that is a very difficult ideology to live through and to accept. And it drives people to despair or to self-abuse. I mean, look at all the people who are indulging in abusive and addictive behaviors. Yeah. It's partly because they've got nothing to live for, because they've got no anchor in their lives. So inevitably people are going to ask what is the meaning of life, look for religions, and it's not surprising therefore that at some point many of those people will say, hang on a moment, Christianity has abandoned us, we've abandoned Christianity, Christianity has failed, what was there before? What came before? Because it hasn't always been here. Not everyone will go so far as to think in those terms, but many people with. You've got another aspect, of course, which is that on the outskirts, as it were, of Western society, but also entrenched within it now, not all monotheistic religions have collapsed in self-doubt and self-questioning. There still is a form of monotheism which is very self-assertive, very self-confident, and which in fact is very aggressive in parts, which of course is Islam. And that appears to many people, I'm just saying this because it is a fact, it appears to many people as a sort of threat to our way of life, because it's a very different way of life. And yet it's gaining more and more influence. And it's partly doing so through its aggressive stance, to put it mildly, on many issues. And you have a sort of good cop, bad cop scenario with Islam. So you have the much vaunted, hardworking, decent, law-abiding Muslims who are making a contribution, volunteering for things, and setting up new businesses and all the rest of it, and aren't they admirable? And all they really want is a few little more reasonable concessions to the Islamic way of life. Whereas then you have, they're the good cop, and you have the bad cop, who are the people who are planting bombs and going on massacres and suicide bombing expeditions and the rest of it. And it's like being in a cell, being interrogated. The bad cop comes in, slaps you around the face, and you're a shivering wreck. And then the good cop comes in and says, I'm not like that nasty guy. I'm very reasonable. Just sign the little confession. You know, we'll get you off on a few minor charges. And you sort of, you're intimidated into accepting that deal. And it's a bit like that. So that's also in the minds of people, because it's also part of the religious scene of today. So I don't think it's surprising that we have people turning to ancestral faiths. And what is surprising, though, is that the way that Odinism is experiencing this massive expansion is very different from any other religion which has experienced a revival or an upsurge in interest, where normally speaking, particularly with the prophetic religions, the religions which were founded by a particular individual prophetic leader, you have religions or denominations which were which were promoted by someone proselytizing or preaching, a great charismatic or influential leader who perhaps toured the country or who issued lots of literature and became a very influential leader. And this is the case, obviously, with Lutheranism, with Calvinism, with Methodism, which is Wesleyanism, and many other religious movements, where you had one great preacher who went out and converted people. Now, this isn't really happening with Odinism. This isn't what's happening. What is happening is that individuals are coming to Odinism through their own efforts, their own research, their own reading, their own thought processes. And then at some point in this process, many of them will get in touch with us. So we in the Odinist Fellowship, and I think this is true of other Odinist organisations, cannot truly claim credit for this upsurge of interest in Odinism, which is taking place throughout the world, very strong in America, I know, but in lots of other countries. We're sort of benefiting from it, I mean, we are sitting back and just receiving contacts from these people who have already undergone the journey of being restored to their ancestral faith. Now, I would explain that, and the rationalist observer might disagree with my interpretation, but I would explain this by saying it is the gods who are at work, yeah, and who are reaching out to these people, these individuals, and calling them. Some respond, some eventually come into contact with us and join the Odinist Fellowship or other Odinist organizations. And there are still a lot of individualist Odinists out there who are rather isolated. But this is what's happening. So it's a very unusual process of a religious revival, which is taking place in little isolated segments all over the place. And another aspect, which is, I think, very interesting, this might have something to do with the popularity of the internet, I suppose, and social media, but it's taking place all over the world and in a lot of countries that you wouldn't necessarily identify as hotbeds of Odinism or potential areas of Odinic revival. For instance, Russia or Portugal or Chile. You know, you've got people in countries like this, which are not really Germanic heritage countries, where people, for various reasons, are turning to Odinism. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. And we are part of this, obviously. It's a very diffuse and, to some extent, incoherent movement. And so an organization like the Odinist Fellowship strives to give it some direction, some guidance, some cohesion, and some degree of organization, because without organization, we're not going to get far and leave our testimony and heritage to the next generation and our legacy. So that's what we're trying to do in the Odinist Fellowship.
Very good. You mentioned early on, you said you get the question of, why are you doing this? Isn't this hopeless? Why revive this thing? And, and you gave a very utilitarian answer. I get that question quite a bit. And I simply just say, because it's true, because the gods are real and I serve them.
Yes.
And therefore,
yes,
it must be done.
Yes.
You know, I don't. The utilitarian answer is absolutely a good one. But
yes,
I just think that we do this because we are driven by something that is greater than us, and that being the holy gods themselves.
So that is a theological approach, really, which is another way of answering the question. Certainly, yes.
You also mentioned about, and this is something that I think Americans, like you mentioned, Americans don't appreciate, and they don't. I had pretty recently, I had Marcus Follin, the Golden One, on here, and he's, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but he's a Swedish guy, and he does videos talking about ethics and working out, and he's really, really a great guy. But one thing that he said during the interview that really struck me was that in Sweden, they have been atheist for so long that he doesn't have any sort of bias towards religion at all. He's kind of approaching it objectively. And I've spoken with other, specifically in Scandinavian countries, Sweden and Denmark and some of these places, they've been atheist for so long. We're talking 2-3 generations of atheism and materialism. So they don't even know how to be religious. And I think Americans kind of don't appreciate that, because the overwhelming majority of heathens or Odinists or what have you, also truer in America, our parents were some sort of something, or our grandparents were some sort of something. You know, my parents, my mom is is like a half-ass Catholic, right? And then her father was a very, very devout Catholic. And then my grandfather on the other side, excuse me, was a very, very devout Church of the Brethren, Anabaptist. So there's still a really, we still remember how to be religious, even if it comes from like a different religion. It comes from Christianity. We're still in touch and remember what it's like to believe in divinity. And I think Americans don't appreciate the hollowness and the materialism brings when it's culture wide.
Yes. I think having there's a good side and a bad side to having the Christian background. The good side is that it gives you a sort of discipline. It gives you a habit of prayer and of worship and of attending communal worship and of thinking in theological and ethical terms. The bad side is that you do it tends to be the case that you bring along some of the Christian baggage with you, which is a difficult process to get yourself out of. But there's also atheist baggage as well, which the people in Sweden that you're referring to have to rid themselves of. So that's a very valid point. I mean, I think you're perfectly right. I have given a utilitarian or a sort of historical reason why Odinism is growing now, but we can concentrate quite rightly, as you say, on the positives, which is that Odinism is such a better religion than Christianity in many respects. It's, as I would say, actually a more conformable to the modern outlook. And people are a bit surprised with me when I say that, because obviously we're sort of restoring an ancient religion. But there are three main points if I compare it with Odinism with Christianity. We do not have the mysteries, the so-called mysteries, the unintelligible theology of like the Trinity, three persons in one God. Father is God, the Son is God, the Holy Ghost is God, but they're not, that doesn't make three gods, that makes one God, and all the virgin birth and all this sort of thing. We don't enforce a belief in miracles, which is absolutely central to Christianity, the virgin birth, the resurrection, and so on, are key elements of Christian theology. And we also, I think, are less doctrinaire about ethics, so that people have to be, we believe that people have to be their own judges and decide on their own behavior according to their own lights, which isn't meant to be a cop-out by any means. It's meant to say that someone else can't judge you. You have to judge yourself, and that is actually more difficult, but it's more conducive, I think, to the modern mind. So I think in many ways it's a more modern religion. But one way in which we're very much at an advantage, I would say, than Christianity, and which creates a sense of relief in coming to Odinism from a Christian background, is we don't have this guilt complex where basically the Christians believe that each of us is a miserable sinner, unworthy being, we're a worm. We're even as a child is unregenerate sinner and has enmeshed in mortal and original sin, and God has to, through his infinite kindness, forgive us and absolve us of our sins, and therefore save us from the punishment which he had stored up for us in hellfire, which is a totally, it's a totally contradictory theology. The notion that God, that the Christian God, is so loving because he saved us from hell, which he himself has created for us, because he's so vindictive that he was going to send us there unless we toe the line and accept all his beliefs and doctrines and also behave ourselves. This sort of guilt complex that Christianity has, we don't have in Odinism, so we don't obsess about sin, forgiveness, atonement, punishment, and all the rest of it. So it's a very different mindset. And I think that comes as a huge relief. It sort of relieves the burden. And we can instead concentrate on trying to be better people, not in a self-critical, self-judgmental way. We will never be perfect. We're not supposed to be perfect. We can't be perfect. When Jesus said, "Be perfect, even as your father is perfect," that's a terrible thing to tell anybody, because it's contrary to human nature. Even the gods aren't perfect. But we can be better, we can strive to be to exercise the virtues better and to strive for wisdom. We can do these things, and if we don't fail, we can pick ourselves up and brush ourselves down and get on with the task of living our life as well as we can, and without the guilt and without the recrimination and without the judgmentalism. And that's something I think very refreshing in Odinism.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think one of our biggest boons is that we are a very life-affirming religion. You know, it's said over and over again that the afterlife is fine. You know, it's what it's kind of described as a gloomy bliss, right? It's fine. You get to go be with your ancestors in the hall until you are reborn and so on and so forth. But it is, life is better. It says that life is better. Life is glorious. Life is good. Life is beautiful and all this kind of, it's very, very life affirming, everything about it. And it's not, when you mentioned baggage from Christianity, one of the things that I had to kind of get out of my mind is the presuppositions of transcendentalism is effectively what I had to clean out. This idea of a singular soul being in a meat machine and then eventually going on into a final resting place. And I had a short period where I was an atheist, but I was a very bad atheist. I was just kind of trying to explain. I still believed in supernatural things and paranormal things, but I just tried to explain them in material terms with pseudoscience. And so I was just a very bad atheist. But what I had to really clean out of my mind is this really kind of toxic worldview that comes along with transcendentalism, and you find it in not just Christianity, but there's other Indo-European religions that have adopted it over time. You know, Buddhism, for example, is very transcendental. And I'm not trying to come at Buddhists too much, but there are just, they have a worldview that's just not compatible with ours. You know, they are very much of the mind that you must say these mantras over and over again. You live in kind of ascetic piety your whole life until eventually you can leave this world of suffering and sin and whatever. Yes. And ascend and eventually become a god. And we have the view of, no, life is great. You go to the afterlife, then you get to come back and do life again, right? And being a man is great, and this is a gift from the gods, and it's life-affirming. Would you agree with that?
I'm not a believer in reincarnation, actually, but I do agree with a lot of things you're saying, which is that we are life-affirming. And basically, we're living this life. We're in this life at the moment. So this is a task that we have to concentrate on. And as you say, the monastic religions, which teach asceticism, and that we have to give up life or retreat from life, that's not the right attitude. We have to engage in life and in nature and do what we can. Now, you say that life is wonderful. It is, although, you know, some people have a hard time in life, and some and so whatever our life is, we just have to struggle through with it and make the best of it. And I get a lot of inspiration from the myths of the gods, who whatever we understand by Ragnarok, they are aware of the impending impending Ragnarok, which will destroy them, and some of them will be defeated, and yet they still fight on. And it's not a question of, do we fight the struggles of life because we're going to win? It's a question of, we fight in the struggles of life because it's the right thing to do, because it's what we must do, and it's what the gods inspire us to do as well. So there's no place in Odinism for defeatism.
Yeah.
However difficult life is, and it can be very difficult for some people, and there are people who are have very unfortunate circumstances or are very sick and all this sort of thing.
Of course.
But it's the struggle which is worthy, and not winning the battle, but just fighting the battle. And sometimes, you know, I have to admit, I find it a struggle to get out of bed in the morning, but that's a little bit of that struggle that I do get out of bed eventually, and that's the first step of the day, and then I carry on.
Yeah.
But you know, I think this is what we can all do. And I think the essential idea in Odinism, which you see in the myths, why are the gods always fighting the giants and the enemies of Asgard? What is going on here? I see it as a struggle between the forces of order, the natural order of the cosmos, of life, creativity, all these positive things, growth and nature, against the forces of chaos and disorder. It's not so much evil, but the stifling effects of death, destruction, degeneracy, and decline. And you look at the giants, there are rock giants, there are frost giants, and there are fire giants. Well, frost giants, you think of the frozen wastelands of the north, where practically nothing can survive, nothing can live, certainly human life can't live, crops can't grow, trees can't grow. That's what the frost giants represent, not evil, but the suppression of nature, as it were. Or the rock giants, you think of the barren wastelands of the mountainsides, where there is no growth. Again, that's not evil, but the suppression of life and the impulse of the life force and the growth of nature. And fire giants, you think of these volcanoes which are occurring, and they spew their ash all over the place and suffocate everything that is unfortunate enough to be within its domain. And that's what the fire giants are. So it's the stultification of life, the suppression or stifling of life, and that they represent the sort of negation of the life force, whereas the gods are for the natural order. And that has huge ramifications when we start looking around us and saying, well, why is there so much chaos? Why is there so much anti-life influences in our social setup? Why is a family under attack? Why is a nation under attack? Why is religion under attack? Why is morality under attack? You look at all these things, and they are part of what the gods are fighting against. We are for the natural order, and this is what the religion is really about. And that gives us a role, because we are loyal to the, we belief is important, of course, but our religion focuses on loyalty. Loyalty to the gods. You can't be loyal to something you don't believe in, of course.
Yeah.
But we are loyal to the gods. The gods I see as our generals, as our leaders. Now, it's very well having brilliant generals, but if they don't have an army, or if their army is deserted, they're not going to be very strong. And we are their army. And of course, we need the generals. We need the officers. We need the captains. But we're all fighting together in our different theatres of operation. You know, and for some people that might be, I don't know, weaning themselves off an addiction, or just getting their children to school on time and sorting their lives out in the house. And in the wider socio-political context, it can be fighting against the forces of degeneracy and chaos, which seem to be overwhelming the social order. Mm-hmm. Or, and in nature, it can be fighting those forces which are destructive of nature. So it has all sorts of ramifications, I think, in art, in literature, in every field of creativity. You can see the same struggle going on. So it's sort of quite like a world philosophy, that once you grasp onto that eternal and ever-continuing conflict, which forces everybody to take a side, once for one side or the other, and you can sort of interpret the whole, like a dialectic, you can interpret the whole of history, the whole of nature, the whole of our society, the whole of our personal life through that lens.
And I would actually like to point out that, you know, Mr. Harrison said that the gods are generals. One of Odin's names is Herjafodr, which which means father of the hosts, and host is an archaic word for armies. That means that he is like the grand general, right?
Yes.
So, Mr. Harrison, we could be here all day.
You can call me Ralph.
I'm sorry. It's just it's like, I guess it's an American thing too.
All right, sorry. I don't mind.
All right, Ralph, it's so hard for me not to.
I'll answer to anything.
So, we could be here all day talking theology and ethics and philosophy and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, one of my favorite things to talk about. But I know the guys want to hear about the temple and the fellowship and everything like that. So let's switch over and talk about how someone can join. Let's talk about how can somebody join the Odinic or the Odinist Fellowship?
Right. Well, we only operate throughout the British Isles, mm-hmm. so we only have members because there are different organisations in different countries. But anyone who's resident within the British Isles and who's an Odinist or is interested in Odinism can join the Odinist Fellowship. How can they do that? They can write a letter to us at Odinist Fellowship, B.M. Edda, London, WC1N3XX, that was WC1N3XX, or they can send an email to odinist.fellowship@pobroadband.co.uk, or they can contact us through Facebook and various other means. We have a website which is www.odinistfellowship.co.uk, and the New Odinist Temple also has a website which is www.odinisttemple.uk, and there's a contact page and email facility on that, so people can contact us that way as well. And we have, as I say, a Facebook page. There's an Odinism UK Facebook page which is an open Facebook page which people can also contact us through. So there are several means, I think, of contacting us. And all I send out is a very brief application form, which is sort of like a reply coupon for them to state what their position is, whether they are believers or whether they're not believers but sympathetic to our work. And we have sort of two classes of membership there, for depending on how they answer that question. And then they receive a welcome pack, and regular mailings are round robins throughout the year. We don't have a membership fee or subscription fee, though obviously people are welcome to make donations. And we do have a scheme called the Odinist Temple Fund, where people make regular donations every month, which are all dedicated to our temple's project, which is we're very ambitious. We want to establish a nationwide network of temples throughout Great Britain. And we've taken the first step to do that. Now, the Odinist Fellowship does have a number of local organisations, which we call HALs. They're similar to what in America you call kindreds. And there are about a dozen of them throughout the country. So members are welcome to go along and join in with these HALs, and or to come to the Odinist Temple at Newark if they're able to do that. And we have regular rituals. We have a calendar, a ninefold calendar, nine festivals a year. And what we do at the New Odinist Temple is we always celebrate it on the actual date of the festival, but we also have rituals on the nearest Sunday, because that's a convenient date, Sunday afternoon, for people who are coming from further afield or who have young children or who have work commitments to come along then as well. So we have a couple of rituals for each of our festivals. And I can talk a little bit about the festivals if you like, because that might
interest
your American. So we have the quarter days, which we call Yule, Easter, Midsummer and the Harvest Festival, celebrated on the eve of the quarter days, which are the equinoxes and solstices. So we're coming up in a few weeks to Yule, which is a very popular one. We have sing a few carols, actually, but we've written our own carols or adapted our own carols, not the Christian carols, mm-hmm. and sort of based on folk tunes like that. We're not terribly good at singing, but we enjoy a little bit of singing every now and again. But the rituals which we conduct are called the Cup of Remembrance, and this is basically a sacrifice of mead. So we take a hornful of mead and we bless it or consecrate it with a Thor's hammer, and then we pour as a sacrifice some of this mead into a trigill or sacred bowl containing soil of the motherland, or if we celebrate it out of doors, we pour it onto the earth as a sacrifice to the gods and goddesses. And this is a very sacred ritual, and we believe it's a very magical ritual as well, because we're giving a gift, a symbolic gift, to the gods, and we ask for a blessing or a gift in return, whatever that might be, whatever the intention of the ritual is. So I do believe that it has a very strong magical power. Mm-hmm. And we then pass the horn round amongst the faithful, and they often like to raise the horn and make a pledge or a toast or a prayer or say a poem maybe to the gods, and then we pass it round. And before this, we say a number of prayers, and we have some readings, usually from ancient literature, from the Eddas or from similar ancient literature, you know, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, or from other historical sources, or the Heinz Kringla sometimes. And so whatever is appropriate to the festival that we're celebrating. So this is the form of our worship. And then we have a discussion afterwards. We don't have a sermon, we have a discussion, usually on a set theme that's introduced by myself or one of the other members of the congregation. So this is how we operate. And we also have open days. Our temple is open every Newark is open every Wednesday, or more or less every Wednesday afternoon, which is the market day in Newark. People say, oh, is it because it's Woden's Day or Odin's Day? Well, partly, but partly because it's a busy day in Newark when the market is then. And people come in, you know, shoppers and passers-by, as well as pilgrims. We even had, we've had people from all over. We've had people from California, from Poland coming over, and all sorts of places to visit us. We've had the mayor come in to have a look around, and he was very impressed by how we'd restored the building. We'd had our Rotary Club come round, and I give people a little tour if they want one, because we have these beautiful paintings in the temple at Newark, seven paintings of the gods, one of which is a very beautiful painting by an American painter. He sent the painting all the way from America, and I had to pay taxes on it, as import taxes. So we have seven of the gods and goddesses illustrated. It's not a very big place, so we haven't got room for more. But it's a very good introduction, explaining about the pictures and what they represent. It's a very good introduction to aspects of the mythology for people who are very new to it. So sometimes I do a little tour if people want that, or I can let them look around on their own, and I give them a leaflet at the end of it. So we've had hundreds of people visit our temple in the years that it's been opened, which was opened in 2014. And we've also conducted weddings and namings. We haven't so far, touch wood, had any funerals, but we've had a number of weddings and namings of infants. So we do that sort of thing as well. And we get quite a few inquiries about weddings, actually. So that's the sort of thing that we've been doing. Ideally, if we'd have had a bigger building, we'd have very much liked it to be used as a sort of meeting place for other organisations, other as long as they're not anti-Odinist organisations, other organisations, you know, or clubs or societies. But we need a bigger premises to do that, really. And that would have been a way in which we could have introduced more people to get them to come into the building and just sort of absorb the atmosphere, the Odinist atmosphere of the buildings. It's the new Odinist temple is a very lovely little building. It's a bit of a TARDIS effect, you know, it looks bigger on the inside than it does on the outside somehow. It's quite a tall building, and it's got some very large windows which let in a lot of light. It's obviously an old building, built in the 16th century in 1556, which is the Tudor period, but the style of architecture is more medieval architecture. And it's the decor inside is sort of pastel shade, so it has a quite nice homely atmosphere, I think. People feel, you know, at rest in it. It's quite a nice place to come inside and be contemplative, I think, as well. So we were very lucky with obtaining this. Now, in the Odinist Fellowship, of course, as I was saying, we have members. We send out regular newsletters. We have an Odinist yearbook, which contains information about all our halls, about the calendar, and about of the forthcoming year, and of literature for sale, all this sort of information. And we have a regular annual gathering for people around the country, which we treat as a sort of all thing when we make our laws and regulations. And one thing that we're doing at the moment, our liturgy, our form of worship, might be a bit more formal than some people are used to, perhaps. We've got it all printed out in a book form, but we're producing a hard book, hardback version, edition of this book of rites now. And that is at the printers at the moment. So I've been very preoccupied with sorting that out. But at our last gathering, as at previous gatherings, we discuss and put to the vote of all the members who attend, any changes, anything that they want to comment on, either about the liturgy, which has preoccupied us recently, or about other matters, or about our temple bylaws and such like. So we operate a sort of open democracy when any full member can attend our gatherings and vote on it. Not everybody wants to attend the gatherings, obviously, but those who do are equal members. And we very much believe in the priesthood of all believers as well, which I try and encourage other people to get involved with so that they also perform the rituals. Now, there are a lot of people who don't want to do that and who feel rather shy about talking in public and so on. So not everybody wants to adopt that role, but intrinsically, we're all equal. Everyone is a priest. So I do encourage others to celebrate the rites at the temple if they choose to do that. So that's given you a bit of an overview. Do you want me to talk a little bit, Dave, about how we are recognised in English law? Is that of interest to your listeners? And our charitable status and how we acquired the temple and so forth?
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question.
All right. Well, in this country, in Great Britain, we don't have a system that they do in a lot of continental countries where religions are registered. Now, I think we're probably a bit more similar to what happens in America, probably. But in a lot of continental countries, you have a Ministry of Religion or a Ministry of Justice, which has a religion department. And if you want to start a religion, as it were, or a denomination, you have to register yourself to be recognised. We don't have that system. The nearest we have is charity law. And we have in England and Wales a charity commission. There's a separate one in Scotland. And they can register religious charities. They have to meet certain criteria. First of all, they have to meet criteria about whether or not they constitute a religion according to English law and English charity law. And all of this could be obviously contested in a court of law ultimately. So the Charity Commission has a sort of semi-judicial function in deciding whether or not an organisation actually constitutes a religion and whether ideology is a religion or not. For instance, Scientology, it's been decided in the law courts in England is not a religion, is not recognised a religion. So there's a legal aspect to this which could be contested. Now, many years ago, and this is going back 30 years or more, we decided to apply for charitable status as a religious charity. And the reason for that, we didn't have any ulterior motive particularly, was but at the time, the advancement of religion was one of the small number of headings under which an organisation could be registered as a charity. And as that's what we do, we're advancing religion, the oldest religion, we thought, well, it's only sensible that we should get ourselves registered. And so we had to go through the whole procedure of proving that we recognise deities. They actually said supreme deity, but we pointed out we're polytheistic and they sort of accepted that. And that we have religious rituals and we have a religious philosophy of life and we have an ethical code and we have religious texts, although they're not divine scriptures, they are religious texts. And so we met these various criteria as well as the other criteria for being set up as an organization, you know, a constitution, a bank account, list of officers, minutes of the last meetings, all this sort of thing. So we provided all that. And then they came back with us. Obviously, we had been advised that although the law stated that the advancement of religion was of itself a charitable cause, we had been advised that this was meant to imply only monotheistic Christian or Jewish religious charities, and they were the only ones that had been registered as religious charities hitherto. So we were told that we didn't stand much chance. And the Charity Commission was obviously a bit perplexed by our application, which was rather unusual. And so they asked us for a monograph being a long article or booklet produced by a university professor at a university specializing in religious history, stating that Odinism is a genuine religion. And as it happened, we were able to provide them with just such a monograph. So we got registered as a religious charity. It doesn't sort of really affect us greatly. We do get what is called gift aid, which means that donations to us are tax-free and we can reclaim the tax on that. So that's a minor advantage to us, and we get about, you know, over £1,000 or £1,500 a year in gift aid, which is important to us, but it wasn't the original reason for doing so. And so we've been operating as a religious charity, but it sort of opens up other doors because you're sort of recognised. And when we got the New Codinist Temple, we set it up as a what we call a charitable incorporated organisation, which is a type of charity which is incorporated. So it's like a company, except it's registered with the Charity Commission, not with Companies House. And it's similar to your incorporated association in America. And this means we can actually own property and we could sell property and take out loans and do other things that companies can do. And again, we had to go through the process where we thought that we'd already established, as far as the Charity Commission was concerned, that the Odinist religion is a genuine religion, but we had to, they asked us to prove all that again. So we had an enormous amount of paperwork to go through with them. And then they asked us lots of other sort of queries that we had to go through. And we had to have sort of three-way calls with their legal advisors and answer lots of legal questions. But eventually we got the charitable status for the New Codinist Temple Trust. And that was also helpful to us. But there is a lot of sort of administrative work involved in that. And then we also registered it under English law. We actually have an Act of Parliament, which states that you can register religious places of worship as places of worship. So we had to register that. And that again meant that the registry office, which deals with this, had to create a new denomination on its database of Odinist, you know, to register us. And it all takes a lot longer for us than anybody else. But we went through all these various, we leapt through all these various hoops and got through in the end. So it's all a question of trying to fight for recognition and legal recognition. So we've done that process. Now, we were very, very lucky with the New Codinist Temple. It was originally an almshouse chapel, which is like a chapel attached to houses set up for the poor, as I say, going back to the 16th century. And the ownership of it, by a strange set of coincidences, because the original charity for these almshouses had folded up, the ownership of the temple was in the hands of the local authority, the district council, which is a very unusual situation. And we're in a position now where there was a deal of austerity and local authorities were trying to offload their assets, you know, to save money and to gain some income and so forth. The building itself is a listed building, so it's protected by law, so no one can knock it down because it's of historic interest. Mm-hmm. But it's too small to convert into residential use, and a lot of religious buildings which are being abandoned by the churches are often turned into flats or houses or other uses, or shops or something like that, because there isn't the demand for religious buildings anymore. But this was really a bit too small for that to take place. So it was something of a white elephant as far as the council was concerned. And they'd locked it up, which was very sad. And when you lock up an old historic building, of course, it tends to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. And the council weren't terribly good owners of the property. So we were very lucky that it was therefore relatively cheap for us to purchase. Now, they put it up on a public auction, and we were bidded against by the Quakers. The Quakers are quite a wealthy little community, actually. Yeah. And they didn't have anywhere in Newark, which is a fairly small market town, for them to meet, although there was a handful of them in the town. And so they bidded against us. It was a totally nerve-wracking experience bidding in an auction. But they put the price up about £12,000, which was a bit annoying. But anyway, we actually beat them at the bid and purchased it. And then we had to undertake a programme of restoration. And there was a lot of, I won't bore you with all the details, but we put in a new floor. The floor was actually rotten. We started using it as soon as we purchased it, but we had to tell people not to stand too close to the edges of the floor because they it might collapse, sort of thing. But, you know, we had to change the floor. We had to put in an underflow, airflow and that sort of thing, and get in architects and builders to advise us on this. So I've learned an awful lot about the importance of breathability in old buildings and this sort of thing. And then we had to decorate it and furnish it and also commission the artworks, the lovely paintings. And we managed to do all of that within 13 months, which was quite a, quite a remarkable. Yeah, we spent a lot of money over it. And then we spent another 3 years negotiating with the council to get some bollards attached so that there wasn't lots of ad hoc parking on the forecourt around the temple, which was rather causing us a nuisance. So so we went on from there. So that's sort of a brief history of how we acquired it. And I do think that the gods had a... it was a difficult process, but I think the gods had a hand in it because we were very, very lucky. We'd had this owner's temple fund set up for a number of years, and we'd acquired a certain amount of money in it, but it was nowhere really near enough to purchase a building. And only a year previously to our getting involved in purchasing the building, someone asked me, how long do you think it will be before we can actually acquire our first temple? And I had to say, well, I don't know, because although our savings were mounting up a little bit, the prices of property was going up even more so. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the church buildings, it seemed to be in chapels, were being sold off, you know. And so the market was reducing as well as the prices going up. So I wasn't terribly optimistic. And then this came along in the town where I live, so I can look after it and visit it, you know, every couple of times a week at least, to keep an eye on the property, because you do have to keep an eye on property, and have open days and invite people in. And we got it for a very reasonable price. So I think the gods had a say in that and had a hand in that, that our way was smoothed out remarkably.
That's incredible. Especially, you mentioned the Quakers here in Pennsylvania, where I'm from, is a Quaker state.
And that's right.
They are a, I'll say, they are a subversive group, actually. They are not, they're not our kind of people. I'll just say that, especially in recent years with how the way that the modern worldview has evolved, they have completely bent a knee to it and embraced it, and they do all kinds of weird, kooky, gross stuff, and they're just they're not our guys. You know what I mean?
Are they also quite wealthy? They tend to be quite wealthy, and yes, they've gone in. They set up a lot of businesses, like, I don't know whether you've heard of Cadbury's, you know, it's a chocolate making company that's very well known in this country. That's a Quaker. There's quite a lot of Quaker businesses or Quaker founded businesses. So they've got a hand in business very much. But so we were quite lucky. You're quite right. They're pacifists, of course. They always have been. But they used to going back a while, maybe 50 years, there used to be reasonably Orthodox Christians who believed in the Bible. They don't, they have very simple services. They will sit around in silence and so forth, and they don't do the Holy Communion or baptism, but they used to be basically fairly Orthodox Christians. But now they've sort of actually not really even committed to being Christian anymore.
Yeah.
So you can join the Quakers and not believe in Jesus or God even. So they are completely amorphous like that.
Yeah.
But on the same time, they are very internationalist, very pacifist, as they always have been. And as you say, they are sort of supporting the forces of decadence and degeneracy, basically.
Yeah. And you, for folks that maybe go into reading some of the history of the colonies and look at like the Philadelphia assemblies and all the stuff that happened here in America, every time that there was something lousy that happened in history, if you go look at who signed the papers, you'll find Quakers.
It's out. Oh, right.
It's
yeah. Well, I've got a bit of, as I say, I've got a bit of a I got a bit of a grudge against them, because they yeah. cost us £12,000, which is a lot of money for us. We are quite a small and poor community, really. We don't, about the members of the Onis Fellowship, obviously we welcome all sorts of people. We're very happy to have doctors and scientists and dentists and barristers and that sort of people. But on the whole, I think we're sort of more blue collar and always have been.
Sure.
We tend to be quite young, I think, which is good. And we've got a lot of families. We're very welcome children to come along. You know, they might be a little bit noisy and everything sometimes, but we have some children who are regular members, and there are some of them who are so keen, or they're so enthusiastic about the temple. They love the temple and they bring their parents along, you know. So that's really heartening when you see that. Young children of 5 or 6 who are really enthusiastic about it all. And so we very much welcome them. But we tend to be, we're very scattered. We tend to have people, lots of people unemployed. We tend to have people who are looking for jobs, and we tend to have people in sort of the blue collar sort of types of work predominantly. Obviously we welcome everybody,
yeah.
But so we're not a rich community, I think. And we don't have huge access to the media and all the rest of it. But where I think we do stand out, I mean, if I could talk about my little town of Newark-on-Trent,
sure.
We have a huge parish church, which dominates the town with a huge spire, but it hasn't had a vicar, it hasn't had a clergyman for about a year. The last clergyman, who was a young, sort of left-leaning, quite a nice chap, really, I met him, and he was quite friendly to us, but he was a bit of a lefty, you know, beardy lefty, and he left, I think, in the middle of the pandemic, he left to study politics, so that tells you a lot about it, and they haven't managed to replace it. And I remember him saying, when they invited him along to look at the church, he said to himself, "Oh, they'd never give me, a young clergyman, probably his first posting, a huge, big church like this," but they did give it to him. So it's quite a prize, because it's quite a prestigious church, you know, and they haven't been able to find a clergyman for it. So that tells you a lot of things. Then we have the Baptists, who have historically been quite an important Protestant denomination. They just folded up. Their church is for sale, and there's no takers for it. And then there's a sort of evangelical church in the town, which has folded up as well. So we're continuing and we're growing and we're getting inquiries and we're getting visitors and we're having our open days and we're having people come around and you know, sort of we're making steady progress in the right direction. And then we've got other hearths. Some hearths are livelier than others, but we've got some hearths that are growing very well. And of course, if we had the money, we purchase a property in the right place, but we're still saving up money for such a purpose. But we're making steady progress in the right direction. Obviously, I'd like to make more progress, but we're at least going in the right direction. So I think that's quite important. When other people are clearly going backwards.
Yeah, exactly. I would agree completely. I live in a very old part of the United States. You know, here in Pennsylvania, some of these towns were established, and we're talking in the 1700s, and were colony towns from back Pennsylvania Colony, which was speaking of Quakers, it was started by William Penn, who was a devotee of John Fox, and kind of stuff. But there are quite a few very old church communities that are in my area. Now, it's overwhelmingly Anabaptist, and people that aren't familiar with that, that's where the Mennonites and the Amish come from, the Anabaptist Church of the Brethren. And then probably next to that are Roman Catholics. You drive past these big, beautiful Catholic churches and these big, beautiful, some of these like Lutheran churches and stuff on a Sunday, and they're just completely empty. You might see one, two cars. And then on the flip side, you drive through the city and you see some of these Unitarian churches with the rainbow flags, and it's completely filled. But anyway, it's pretty crazy. But I remember I'm driving down, and there's a strip in my hometown where there's four churches on it. I drive down Sunday morning church time. Each parking lot has maybe one or two cars, maybe a couple old people standing out front, completely empty. And then the next day, I had a bloat at just at my house, and my clan came, my kindred came. And I remember standing there at the fire when we're doing our bloat, like just literally in my yard, which isn't very big. And I'm looking around at everybody there. I'm like, there's literally more people here in my backyard and my little clan than there was at all four of those big, beautiful churches.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes. Well, that's the way things are going. And I know in America, what's the name of your kindred, actually? Can I ask that, Dave?
We are the Schaeferling clan. We operate, we use clans. We've kind of gotten away from the kindred system a little bit.
All right. That's interesting. Yes, that's the way we're going. It was to some extent. I mean, we didn't have very much money, so we couldn't have purchased a huge property. But it was our sort of idea that we didn't want a large premises anyway. And there were practical reasons for it. There are two main reasons. One is a practical reason that buildings need maintenance, and they need heating as well. And they need looking after, and money is being spent on them, and they need insurance and all the rest of it. So they are a bit of a burden in that sense.
Yeah.
But the larger building you have, you know, you're going to be spending, possibly having huge repair bills coming in, which you don't really want. You want sort of something that is fairly cheap to run. So I must say that the New Codings Temple is relatively cheap to run. We don't have too much in the way of bills coming in. And the other thing is, I think, that if you have 20 people crowded into a relatively small space, you feel that you've got a really good attendance and you've got a really good atmosphere going on. And if you have the same number of people in a huge, you know, vast church which you somehow acquired or something like that, you feel, oh dear, you know, there are so many
Where's
empty
everybody
spaces.
At?
Yeah. So I think it's better to be a little bit cozier and a little bit more huddled together, and you can always have more than one service, more than one ritual for a particular festival, can't you? Actually, I was talking about that. You were asking me about the festivals, weren't you? And I mentioned a bit about it, about the quarter days. I didn't mention the rest of them. And that might be quite interesting to your listeners because it's a bit of an English perspective. Again, talking about the town I live in, there are in the town various festivals, I suppose you would call them, which people observe and which do have a following, one of which is Remembrance Day, which is to do you call it Remembrance Day or Armistice Day or Veterans Day?
Veterans Day, yeah.
Veterans Day. So that still has a great pull. Now, what happens normally in the town is you get the vicar or somebody like that, who usually leads it, outside the War Memorial, and you get people and veterans parade and so on with their flags, and people lay their poppy wreaths. We have poppies as a symbol of it in this country. And then he says a little talk about the importance of people who have sacrificed their lives, and so maybe says a little prayer, but it's basically totally nothing to do with Christianity. And this is Odinist in spirit. It's about the Einherjar, after all.
Yeah.
And we have Einherjar, which we celebrate on the 11th of November, which is Armistice Day. But November always was a period of remembering the dead and sacrificing to the dead and slaughtering of cattle and having bonfires and all this sort of thing. So we have that. We re-paganize it and call it the Festival of Einherjar or Heroes Day. And same with our patron saint, which is Saint George. Now, Saint George is the dragon slayer. There's a parade in town again, and the Boy Scouts and Girl Guides go to the parish church. Well, that's got nothing to do with Christianity either, to be quite honest. And it is just a reincarnation of the Sigurd legend, Sigurd the dragon slayer. And so we repaganize that as Sigurd's Day on April 23rd, which is our national day. But it's about the dragon slayer. What's that got to do with Christianity? Nothing. It's all based on our ancient legends, with a vague Christian gloss on it. So those are some of our festivals. We also celebrate and remember the founding of our nation. Now, this is something which you Americans do, obviously, with, you know, you have Thanksgiving and you have, you remember the Pilgrim Fathers and so on, and the French do, you know, with Bastille Day, the founding of their republic and everything. We don't do anything like that in this country. We've become so unpatriotic and we've forgotten our roots. But we think that people need to be reminded of this. So we celebrate Hengist Day, which is Hengist and Horsa, the first of the Anglo-Saxon
Very cool.
to come over to England. That was the first of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of Kent, where Hengist took the kingdom. And we celebrate that. That's on May Day because there's a historical reference to the banquet of Ambresbury, where the Hengist and his Jutish followers basically slaughtered the Celto-British leaders and sort of seized political power. And we celebrate the Danish and Norse element, which is very, very strong in this part of the country. This is the old Danelaw, and lots of the place names are still Danish names ending in B and Thorpe and so on. And so we celebrate that, which is Lindisfarne Day, which is the beginning of the Viking period, really, when the raid on Lindisfarne, when they burnt down the monastery and took the wealth and so on, which we celebrate on the 8th of January, which is the date that's recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle for it. And we also celebrate Odin's Martyr's Day, which is Stiklestad Day. We've chosen that day because it was the death of Olaf Haraldsson, so-called Saint Olaf, or Olaf the Fat, as he was also called, and who was one of the greatest persecutors of the Odinist religion, as is well recorded in the Heimskringla. And we have a very powerful ritual and liturgy on that day when we recount all of the references, not just from the Heimskringla, but from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, from the Carolingian Chronicles, all the, you know, the felling of the Irminsul and the burning of the temples of Gudmundhem and the seizing of the temples of Kent, and all these, the slaughter of the Saxons at the River Aller, 4,500 Saxons were beheaded by orders of Charlemagne. Mm. We have a prayer, a service, which recounts all of these. It's very powerful. And we think that that is necessary. That I was taught at school that when Christianity came in, insofar as I was taught anything about it, everybody just accepted Christianity. It was like, oh yeah, this is a much better religion, isn't it? We'd all jump on the Christian bandwagon. And a lot of the Victorian novels, which were set in Viking times, although they have this nostalgia for the Viking period, You get the Christian mission at the end, last chapter, you get the Christian missionary comes in and everyone becomes a happy Christian, you know. And it didn't happen like that. Obviously, there were some voluntary converts, of course there were, but there were lots of people, most people are conservative, and there were lots of people who resisted this, and quite a number of people who actually laid down their life. They were given the choice, you can either convert or you'll be killed, and they said, I'm not going to convert, you'll have to kill me. And that's what happened. And Raud the Strong and Eyvind Kinriver and all these people, Jan Skeggi, Ironbeard, and all these
King
people,
Redbad.
Yes, King Redbird is a very good example as well. And, you know, so we celebrate the martyrs as well on Odinist Martyrs Day. So that is the nine festivals, which we have a ninefold calendar of festivals. It's obviously somewhat Anglo-centric. It's about, sure. It's to do with our country, our history. And, you know, in America, you might want to celebrate, well, I think Eric the Red is someone to celebrate because he was a very good chap. But, you know, I know people celebrate Leif Erikson as well. And, but anyway, that is our religious calendar of festivals, which, so it's not too much of an ask to ask people to come along nine times a year. And it's very good when people manage to do that, but obviously people live in very scattered locations, so we encourage people, as we believe in the priesthood of all believers, to celebrate on their own, to celebrate a sacrifice on their own if they cannot attend a hearth or a temple. So that was an answer to that question.
Very good. So Ralph, we're over an hour, but I have one more question for you before we shut down. So I'm 34. I'd turned 34 this year, and I've been in the community for about a decade now. I've been in here for a while. So I consider myself halfway to becoming an elder. So, but I have noticed that there's been a little bit of a kind of a transformation in the community of the faith and an evolution, and things are much different than what I remember when I first came in. When I first came in, you know, you would go to an event, it would be a bunch of guys there, or sometimes mostly older guys, sometimes there'd be a couple young guys or whatever. But now I see, like, this really blew my mind. I went to the Folkish Summer Halloween from my friends at Ermine Folk here in Pennsylvania, which is a wonderful, wonderful event. It's like it's a big long weekend with lots of events and shops and stuff for the kids. It's just incredible. But there's like pushing a few hundred people there. It was a really big event, and I was shocked at the kind of the demographic of people that were there. There was more children than there were adults. It was young families. It was there was like women there. I was like, it's been kind of a transformation, but not just that, just in the worldview of the average Odinist, of the average heathen, has evolved, and we've developed a little bit more of a sophisticated understanding of our own faith and ethics and philosophy and these kinds of things. What is your experience? Because I know you've been in it longer than me. What is your experience witnessing kind of the evolution, and what have you noticed that has evolved in your time?
Right. Do you mean in terms of the demographics and the profile of Odinists?
Yeah, and also maybe the worldview. What have you noticed has evolved in your time?
I think that I think we've maintained a sort of young profile. I mean, obviously there were some old people who've been around a long time, but they were young when they joined, I think. We do get more young people. It's quite broad though. I think that we've sort of consolidated. What's evolved is that I think the liturgy is very important. The form of worship, we've sort of joined together around that, and it's an opportunity for us to get together and celebrate that. And I noticed at our last gathering, which I did celebrate the ritual at, and there were about 20 people in the hall, and it was such a powerful force, it almost blew me off my feet, almost blew the roof off. you know, there was such an enthusiasm there, I think, in the people not quite shouting the responses, but really giving it their all. And I think we've developed around this liturgy, which we've added to and developed, and we've got, as I said, we're looking forward to a hardback issue of the Book of Rites, and this is where we join around this. I think that is what has come more to the fore.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's excellent. I'm not trying to say that the community in the early days when I came in, well, that wasn't really the early days, but when I came in was just like a bunch of old guys hanging out or anything like that. But there was it was overwhelmingly male. It was overwhelmingly you know, older fellas that had been in it for a long time.
If I look back on the very early time when I first joined an Odinist hearth, I said to myself, which happened to be very near where I lived at the time, and I was living in London, I said to myself, I'm going to give it a year. I'm going to see whether this is really for me. And then I will take the oath, take the pledge of faith. I'll give it a year. And I have to say that a lot of the people I came across were rather eccentric and could have been rather off-putting. And I also think that there was a bit more then. This is what has probably really changed, are people who were almost atheistic in their outlook, if that sounds a bit strange. They were sort of heroic atheists, people who, when it came down to it, they talked about the gods. They were very interested in the heritage. They were very patriotic. They were very attached to the myth lore. But when it came down to it, they sort of didn't really believe it, and they took it as symbolic, perhaps. And I suppose there still are people like that. But I've always thought that the gods are real, and there's no point in having in practicing a religion if you don't really believe in the gods are real. Yeah. Now, I don't impose my interpretation on anybody. And people, it depends on their level of development as to how much they believe in the reality of the gods. But what I would say has probably changed is that it's much more normative now, much more standard, that people really do believe in the gods. And they believe in them as real. So they are willing to pray to them. They believe in them as influences in their life. It's not just a sort of poetic conceit, that some of the people who were influential at the beginning of our religious revival in the 1980s, it really was in this country, really, I don't think had a strong belief, strangely enough, even though they were quite influential in reviving the religion.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that 100%. Yeah. I would say
I think that is really what was similar to what you're saying, I think, because you're talking about old men who were just chatting about it, and I think it's more a question of people believing it. But I did like your description of this fair, this festival that you were having with stalls and families coming along. And I think that would be wonderful to have more of that in this country as well, you know, that we if we could organise something more like that. But I think we would have to grow in numbers for that to be successful. But yes, I mean, we've had various events like camping events and things, which have, but they've had a sort of limited interest. But I think what you're describing, where people could come along and maybe there'd be some, Odinist cooking and Odinist lit books and Odinist sports and all sorts of things that interest different people, and bikers come along and other academics come along, and different types of people find something of interest there, and families and find something of interest for children. That's really what we should be thinking in terms of, you know, and that sounds very good.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the way that the faith is going. You know, you mentioned quite a few times during our discussion about how there's so much more enthusiasm and excitement and growing, and we're not even like doing anything. It's like just selling itself. People, yes. I get contacted all the time. Hey, can I come out? And I talk to people all the time that are in my area and all kinds of stuff. It's really, really incredible. And I really would pin it on the sincerity of people's belief. I would pin it on we are kind of starting to exclude people that are atheistic because like what part of modernity and everything is atheism and materialism? Why do we want more of that? You know what I mean? And why practice a religion if you don't actually believe it? You know, it's like, so, you know, we have people that are more devotional. We have people that are more theistic, that are more serious about their faith. During ritual, people, you know, sometimes people shed tears. They, you know, they really believe it in their hearts. And that is what I think is the secret sauce that is driving us forward.
That's very good. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Dave.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Martel.
So this is we went on an hour and a half. That was we were having such a good talk. I had to keep it going. So would you like to say anything in conclusion, Ralph?
Well, to any Odinists who are in the British Isles, and if you're particularly isolated and you're not a member of an organization, I think it's good to be with others. It's not, we don't impose our way of thinking on anybody. There's no laws and regulations that you're going to have to obey. It's a question of building up the community and building up the faith and passing on a legacy to the next generation and helping us build up this network of temples, which I think is so important and has really inspired a lot of people. People have really been enthusiastic to see, small though it is, to see that we've got some bricks and mortar, which we own the freehold of. No one can evict us. And it's like a refuge for the sane. Instead of a lunatic asylum, I think society at large has gone insane, and we've set up in our temples and in our hearts an asylum for the sane. So do come and join us. You're very welcome.
Beautiful. Awesome. Yeah. So make sure to check them out. I'll have in the description the link to their organization so you guys can go check it out. But beautiful, excellent work, Mr. Ralph. The temple is beautiful and wonderful. And as we talked about earlier, man, we're coming back. I counted something like, I believe there's 15 Hoffs just on the East Coast, 15 temples here on the East Coast in America. Really? Most of them are privately owned. They're smaller, but that's a number. Then there's organizations that are buying churches. There's organizations I know that are getting groves. We're growing. We're coming back. We are, you know, we don't have the support of the state. We don't have the support of the top down. This is a grassroots thing of believers that are putting in work like many other religions that came about and became worldwide powers. Some of them started in caves. Some of them started in really, really humble beginnings. So make no mistake, we are coming back. Man, we don't need the media. We'll make our own media. We don't need their help. We'll be our own help. And we're coming back, and there's nothing they can do to stop us because we have the most powerful beings in the universe on our side, the Holy Golden themselves, and we will achieve victory.
That's absolutely wonderful. As we say in our rituals, we shall rise again. This we swear in Odin's name.
Beautiful. I love it. So we are going to close it out for this evening or this afternoon. I will see you guys next week here on The Bog. Dave Martel, Tristan, and Andre will be coming back, and it'll be on Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, you want to help us keep the lights on, make sure you go to patreon.com/The Bog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody. You can get a sticker. You can get a mug. But most importantly, you can get the RSS feed of every single show that we do to listen to on your commutes, in your car, at work, or at the gym. That is patreon.com/The Bog. You want to support us another way? Make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and get yourself some sweet Bog merch. We got beanies, we got hoodies, we got all kinds of stuff. We got dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies. Go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop. You want to support one of our friends? Go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. The stuff is so cool. Go check it out. Go give them a like. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. But guys, do you guys have a copy of the Bizarchives? Well, you better get one, because our issue 2 is coming out very, very soon next month. We got Cosmic Horror Double Feature by A. Cuthbertson, Bizarchives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines, a reincarnation of the golden era of pulp fiction and weird fiction from aspiring pulp authors from the United States and England. Go check it out at thebizarchives.com. That is THEBIZARCHIVES, thebizarchives.com. So anyway, many blessings, many hails to each and every one of you, the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens out there, and I'll see you guys next week. And I hope everybody had a wonderful, fruitful Thanksgiving. I'll see you guys next time. Hail.